supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. On the surface, baseball appears to be a secular activity, but what if it actually is a road to something else, a road to the divine? Take this description of how captivating the game is by one of baseball's biggest disciples, the character Annie Savoy, played by Susan Sarandon in the 1988 film Bull Durham.
I believe in the Church of Baseball. I've tried all the major religions and most of the minor ones. I've worshipped Buddha, Allah, Brahma, Vishnu, Siva, trees, mushrooms, and Isidore Duncan. I know things. For instance, there are 108 beads in a Catholic rosary and there are 108 stitches in a baseball. When I learned that, I gave Jesus a chance. But it just didn't work out between us. The Lord laid too much guilt on me. I prefer metaphysics to theology. You see, there's no guilt in baseball, and it's never born.
Boy, isn't that the truth? So, if there is such a thing as the Church of Baseball, my guest today is, as described by journalist Bill Moyers, one of the preeminent theologians. He's written Baseball as a Road to God, Seeing Beyond the Game, along with Thomas Oliphant and Peter Schwartz. And he's been teaching that course at NYU Law School for many years. He is the president of New York University, where he teaches a course called Baseball is the Road to God. John Sexton, welcome to Voices in the Family.
It's nice to be with you, Dan.
Well, John joins us on a very special day in American history. It's the 66th anniversary of Jackie Robinson breaking the color barrier in Major League Baseball today, 66 years ago. And I should say that I am 66 years old, so I am a baseball baby or a Jackie Robinson baby, but that's the shadow I was born in. John, as I get to know you through your writing and other interviews, sounds like you were born in Ebbets Field, home of the Brooklyn Dodgers, at the church of John Sexton.
Well, it was close to Ebbets Field, not far from Ebbets Field, out at the beach. But I should say to you, just to connect to today in a special way, when I was named president of NYU, they sent someone over as we prepared for the installation, which of course is a grand sacrament in itself. And they said to me, we have to design your heraldry. Now, I come from a family of Brooklyn Irish Catholics, where if I had heraldry, they'd do some physical damage to me. So I said, just give me a student gown and put a little circle on the sleeve and put the number 42 in that circle. So that is my heraldry, and I'm proud that that Rachel Robinson, Jackie's wife, who just celebrated a few months ago her 90th birthday, is a friend and is an NYU graduate.
Huh. Bless your heart. Bless hers. You open your book with the account of the 55 World Series between the Yankees and your beloved Dodgers. As you listen to the game on the radio with your buddy Dougie, you said you prayed before the radio instead of an altar. Tell me back then, how old were you?
Well, I was born, here comes this number 42 again, in 1942. In fact, in my mind, I think Jackie chose that number to celebrate the year of my
because
birth.
Because of you. I can't think of any other reason.
That's right. He must have had it in mind.
So
in 1955, we were 13 and 14, and we had now, you know, once you each get to what the Catholic Church calls the age of reason, this is when you can begin to confess your Union, which is about 7. It's, you know, it's a little before that, maybe, that you begin to really become a serious member of the Church of Baseball. So we had gone through the annual confrontations, it seemed, between the Yankees and the Dodgers in the World Series. And Dougie and I were the two Dodger fans in our neighborhood. And the big guys, the fellas that in Grease, the movie or the play, wear the black leather jackets, they were Yankee fans. Hmm. And they would get us up against the chain fence in the playground as the World Series approached, and they would say, all right, I can admit it, you know, Berra is better than Campanella, Rizzuto is better than Reese. And of course, we wouldn't. We were like the Christian martyrs as they would pummel us. You know? So, but each year, and of course, going back just to the year before I was born in 1941, the story of those 15 years was a story of frequent deep disappointment for Dodger fans. And but we responded by saying, wait till next year, wait till next year. So here it was, October the 4th, 1955, and in those days, the World Series was played during the day. And usually the nuns would let you listen to a game as important as the deciding game on the radio, because they didn't have radios available to them in the convent, so it was a little joyful for them as well. But we, the eighth grade class at St. Francis de Sales out in Rockaway had done something bad enough that Sister St. James did not let us listen to the World Series. So we come out at 3 o'clock, and we turn on these big transistors, and it's the seventh inning, and the Dodgers are winning 2-0. This may be the year. Dougie and I run home. We go down, as you say, into my basement.
Wait a minute, John. Is this the first game or the seventh game?
This is the seventh game.
Okay, go on.
This is October the 4th, 1955, the day that will change history. You know, this is this. The if we weren't in, you know, already, you know, B.C. and A.D., this would have been the date, no doubt, would have been chosen.
No so, question.
So, it's the seventh game, 2-0, seventh inning. We run down into my basement and we turn on the radio, and it's now going into the ninth inning. And we take this metal crucifix down from the wall, I guess about 15 inches tall, and we're kneeling next to the radio, listening and praying at the same time with this crucifix in dynamic tension between the two of us. And when the ground ball went to Pee Wee Reese, who threw it to Gil Hodges for the last out, Dougie, you know, quite naturally exclaimed by throwing his hands up into the air, but he let go of the crucifix, and the head of Christ knocked off the top of my middle front tooth. And it wasn't until 4 or 5 years ago that the dentist made me fix that. I wore that as a badge of that day, you know, for decades.
What a wonderful story. I mean, there's lots we could make of that. You know, as a psychotherapist, I could talk with you for about 3 hours about, you know, Jesus and that tooth, but I'll restrain myself from
God bless
doing.
You. My wife was trained in psychology, and she said I was the simplest machine she had ever met. Very few moving parts, so you might not get very far.
That's a high compliment. So I want to talk about those Dodgers, and you know, they may have been, well, partly America's team also. I grew up in Atlantic City, 100 miles away, and yet my first baseball glove was a Pee Wee Reese baseball glove, and that was also around 55, 57. I loved Jackie Robinson, and I thought either Richie Ashburn of the Phillies Whiz Kids or Duke Snider, I thought one of them was God. And you talk about saints like these players and sinners, and I guess examples of modern day sinners are like Mark McGwire, Barry Bonds, and Roger Clemens, also caught for steroid use.
Well, the concept of saints and sinners, and of course, what we try to do in the book is we try to use the tools that I used to use when I was a professor of religion. By the time I got to NYU, I was a professor of law. But before I went to law school, I was a college professor of religion, and the courses I taught were by and large about religion as a phenomena. So to go back to Annie's quote to you, you know, metaphysics rather than theology. The courses that I taught sometimes would talk about the doctrines of the various churches. This was in the 60s and early 70s, so there was a fascination with world religions that was developing, and students didn't know the doctrines or... And we sometimes even would talk about the structure of the religions, the hierarchies. But most of where I concentrated my attention was on the experience of religion. So writings like William James or Rudolf Otto or Messiah Eliade. So what I've done in the book is try to take that set of writings and apply it to baseball in a kind of paradoxical way to get students to think strange. And this notion of saints and sinners that you raise is right at the heart, it turns out. This overlap in the way you could analyze either religion or baseball. So you know, one of the first five people in the Hall of Fame was Ty Cobb, who, you know, on the numbers and or between the lines, as they say, was undoubtedly one of the great ball players of all time, but was a vile person, you know, just a morally debased person, some of which came onto the field, but not most of which. And whereas another of the first five in the Hall of Fame, Christy Mathewson, who was a Bucknell graduate and one of the few college-educated men in playing baseball in his time, was by all accounts saintly in his personal life. So even before you get to steroids and sins against the game, you face with the Hall of Fame, for example, are we putting in people who are model people, model citizens, or simply ball players? And we made the decision that we would have this narrow focus as we chose the saints of baseball.
Well, now, you know, if we're just talking about baseball today, I'd love to chat with you about Pete Rose right on this very point. We're talking with John Sexton. He's president of NYU, but he's written a book and teaches a course called Baseball as a Road to God, Seeing Beyond the Game. If you want to join the conversation, our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. John, I want to come back to something you said a couple of minutes ago. When you talked about when you were teaching religion, you talked about the experience of religion, and that answers a question I was about to ask on behalf of my listeners who are non-believers in baseball. And I could hear them saying, come on, it's a game. What are you people doing, for God's sakes? And when you talk about the experience of religion and the experience of baseball, that really addresses it. When I go into Citizens Bank Park to watch a Phillies game, there's a quality of when I get there. You know, it's even when I watch my grandson Sammy, you know, playing baseball in his little league, there's just a quality of, yeah, this is home. I know this. It's like when I go to a visiting synagogue, you know, they speak any English at all there. It's just this a quality of knowing this place in a deep, deep level.
Well, I think you're hitting upon what became the heart of the enterprise, both in the course and in the book. The course went through several stages of evolution. It started when a young person, a student at NYU, came up to me after an NYU event and in a jocular but bellicose way, said to me, "You know, I hear you're a big baseball fan, but you know, frankly, it's boring. It's slow." Mm-hmm. And I channeled the greatest teacher that I ever encountered in my life as a student, who, you know, taught me for 3 years at the formative high school period, and his name was Charlie. And Charlie would always say to us, it was important to think strange. This is where, you know, he found creativity and humanity and so forth. And he'd always present us with oxymorons, you know, the classic ones like the sound of one hand clapping and so on, so, or paradoxes. And I literally challenged him. I almost used his voice, you know, he had his deep voice, and I said to this young man a phrase that he would say to us if he wanted to say to us we were just utterly wrong. "You are among the unwashed," I said to this young man. Indeed, if you will allow me to assign you 12 books, and you'll write a paper over a semester on each of the 12 books, and by the end of it, you'll realize, and this is where I came up with the phrase, baseball is a road to God. Initially, and in 1.0, that was the purpose, just to get a student to think strange. You know, I didn't care if in the end he thought it was a road to God or not, but I was going to force him to examine baseball as a religion, and that was a kind of oxymoron, exactly as you put it in your question. And then 2.0, you know, the following year, when dozens of students showed up and asked to do the same thing, and I created the course, and they were so taken by it. Peter Schwartz, the young man who was helped me on the book, along with Tom Oliphant, was in that first class. He now works for Bloomberg. But he 11 years ago, and his classmates worked with me all through the summer. We continued the course after the semester was over, when met weekly during the summer, because they were enjoying it so much. And I began to realize that stripping, this gets back to the Annie quote, asking the students to strip baseball of the notions of religion that they associate with hierarchy and structure or dogma, and focus only on the experience through the writings and the readings they did, that this was awakening something in them, that they were beginning to feel, whether no matter how they felt about whether baseball was it, they began to see a dimension to religion they hadn't seen before. And then 3.0 was where I think we became aware that in a way that's special. I'm not going to say unique. The title of the book is Baseball is a Road to God. And, you know, I guess there could be a fishing as a road to God, or, God forbid, a football as a road to God. But baseball, because of its timelessness and its precise slowness, that allows you to notice the small things that are deeply significant, like the change in a count, or whether there are runners on base or not when a bat is up, and the time of the game or the season, and all of these things that are so kaleidoscopic and microscopic, but so important to the as you get deeper and deeper and deeper as a fan into the game. And we began to notice that the skills that we were developing as we watched the game, or as we read novels about people who watched the game, or by people who were in the game, juxtaposed with literature on the religious experience, these are the skills of the contemplative life. And then the final thing, 4.0, is to get to exactly where you put us with the introduction to this little monologue of mine, for which I apologize. But the 4.0 was, you know, Eliot talks about the sacred as that which is not profane, and the profane as that which is not sacred. And it's a deeply subjective thing. So when I walk through the outback of Australia and approach what my native Australian guide whose culture goes back 100,000 years calls Uluru as it rises majestically from the outback. And he sees it as sacred, as axis mundi that connects the world of above and the world with us, the spiritual and the obvious.
Well, I've got
I see it as Ayers Rock. It's
yeah.
a beautiful piece of natural beauty. So for some of us, there are moments in baseball that carry that ineffable beauty and transport us beyond.
Well, we've got to take a short break, and I want to talk about that word you just used when we come back from our break, ineffable. And I want to hear about, I'll give you a minute to think about it, John Sexton's God. And we will talk about both. We will also take callers at our number 888-477-9499. We're talking with NYU President John Sexton, author of Baseball as a Road to God, Seeing Beyond the Game. We'll be back in just 60 seconds. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY FM.
Supporting WHYY, Camp Hill Special School, with day and residential options, is a community committed to the care and education of children ages 4 through 21 with mild to severe intellectual disabilities. Dr. Dan Gottlieb makes a presentation at their Phoenixville campus on April 22nd, and the school hosts an open house at their Glenmore campus on April 27th. To register for the presentation on April 22nd and the open house on April 27th, and for more details, camphillspecialschool.org.
The Philadelphia Foundation supports WHYY. Since 1918, the Philadelphia Foundation has strengthened children and families. The Foundation supports nonprofit organizations that enhance parenting, mentor youth, create safe environments, advance individual education, and advocate for children and families. The Foundation can help you make a difference for such southeastern Pennsylvania nonprofits today and forever while you receive tax deductions. The Philadelphia Foundation, 215-563-6417 or fellowfound.org.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. We're talking about Baseball as the Road to God. That's the name of the new book. My host, John Sexton, who some of you know is president of NYU, but more important, he's a huge baseball fan. Before I get back to my interview with John, I want to play another clip from the 88 film Bull Durham. In this scene, two baseball players on the Durham Bulls are waiting for their at-bats. One of the players is prepping his bat, and the other takes notice.
What is that?
Chicken bone cross. Takes the curse off the bat, that brings me hits.
What are you, a goddamn witch?
Yes. A switch hitting witch.
Will that work for me?
If you believe in voodoo.
Jose, I am 0 for 16, a big donut hole for 16. I can't remember the last time I had a base hit. Come on, man, let me have some of that stuff.
Man, that is not belief. That's desperation.
Jose, come on, just touch my bat once. Come on, just once. I won't bother you the rest of the day, I swear to God, just touch the bat once.
That was a scene from Bull Durham. John Sexton, I love the story you tell about how New York Yankee Aaron Boone was facing a difficult knuckleballer in the 11th inning of the game when Derek Jeter went up to him and whispered in his ear, "Don't worry, the ghosts will come." That was referring, of course, to Ruth Gehrig, DiMaggio, and Mickey Mantle. Tell us what happened to Aaron Boone when he heard that.
Well, interestingly, now I used to teach my students when I taught religion, prayer changes people, not things. Right. And apropos of what you just played from Bull Durham, there may be an effect on an athlete, and indeed there was an effect on Aaron Boone, where the person is changed, of course, much like the Rainmakers and so on, we may attribute a different kind of causality to it, the voodoo. But in fact, what happened was that Boone decided, triggered by what Jeter had said to him, to approach the at-bat differently, and that ended up in the great Aaron Boone home run that followed. So this issue of miracles and prayer gets jumbled up with causality and the law of large numbers in ways that we explore in the book. And what we try to say, where we see an overlap, is not in the kind of simplistic level of what I think rightly would be called superstition and false causality, explainable merely by the law of large numbers, but there is a way in which prayer changes the person, or that we experience a miraculous event, meaning an event that somehow brings us to another plane. The word that Eliot coined for this, which is used by students of religion, is a hierophany, literally from the Greek, the sacred shining through. It's baseball as a road to God, not the road, so we're not making the claim that a hierophany for one person is for another. I'm a Catholic, I'm a Christian. For me, at the moment of consecration, the Eucharist becomes the body and blood of Christ. That's a hierophany. That's what I am experiencing on a profound level. For my Jewish wife, it remained bread and wine. So the Boone moment was miraculous for those of us that experienced it, for whom it was a hierophany, precisely because it transported us to this dimension which is labeled sacred by Eliot, which is special, which is different from all others in ways we can't express.
Well, I want to follow up that, and I want to say to my callers, I apologize, we can't get to your calls just yet because this Sexton guy is way too interesting, and I'm not going to let him go for the moment. So
I'm too windy.
Really, you'll So I want to talk about this thing that you talk about, this ineffable thing, ineffable. You know, I'm reminded of psychotherapist Eugene Gendlin, who said that language really fails to describe an experience that we have, that we feel it in our body, that our what he calls felt sense in our body in many respects is more valid than the way we think about it. Some things are in the body, soul cannot be described by the mind, and I'm thinking things like God, the divine, love, even our very own soul, the core of who we are, can't be described in words.
And the classic word for that in most of the great religious traditions of the world is this word ineffable or some equivalent thereof. That which cannot be reduced into cognitive categories or words. So this is at the core of the course and the book. And this is dangerous territory for the president of a research university and one that prides itself on having terrific research going on in neuroscience, for example. But let me tread nonetheless. There is the known. And we live in a century where that which is known is vastly more than that which was known even half a century ago. Then there is the knowable, which we may not come to know for 1,000 years. My colleague at NYU, the great philosopher, Thomas Nagel has written a book where it was found by some to be very controversial, that he said simply that this category of the knowable may become known to us in ways we can't imagine knowing today. Well, in other words, that our ways of knowing today may be very primitive, looked back upon 50 or 100 years
from now. Let me interrupt you here, because you know, you commented on that which we know, which is so much more than we knew, you said, even a half century ago. But when you compare that to that which we don't know, it's not even a drop in a bucket. And I think I agree with you, we overvalue that which we know, because we've got this grand delusion that it's more than a drop in the bucket.
I agree with you, Dan, and one of the things I say, even as I celebrate science as we know it today in the book, and I do as in my life as a research university president, we have to be dangerous about a scientism developing, that we have all the answers. But I'm going even a step farther beyond where Tom Nagel is and where you just brought us. I'm saying, in addition to the known today and the knowable, which we can come to know in some millennium, will come to know, there is that which is unknowable in the sense of being put into cognitive categories or words, and that's this category of the ineffable. And that, as you said so correctly, is the domain that at least in the way we approach religion in the course, that is the domain of the religious experience. It is the domain of human love. It is known through mythos, not the American sense of myth as falsehood, but mythos in the sense of the experienced truth.
I've got to tell you, as a psychotherapist, that's one of the core sadistic dialectics of being human, because we hunger to be known at the deepest core, accepted by lovers and accepted by the community for who we are at core, and yet we can never be known for who we are.
And we come closest to it, as you said, in love, and especially in the I-thou love affair, which is in the classic sense that Martin Buber described it, the complete emptying of self in as far as we can into another. So, and I have been blessed in my life with being loved by the person I love most in the world, but Lisa did not convince me by a syllogism that she loved me. I experienced it.
It was an experience. But by the way, John, I know that your beloved Lisa died suddenly. Where is she now for you?
I don't locate where she is as a physical place. Just as you foreshadowed before the break, I have a view of, quote, God, close quote, and I take Paul Tillich's view that if the word is a problem for you, get it out of the way. What I'm trying to describe is a depth of being that goes beyond the obvious, and she is very real to me, and I live my life daily trying to be worthy of her love. I, as a matter of faith, and this is not something I can prove, otherwise it would not be faith, and it is something about which I have doubt, because faith means nothing if there's no doubt. But I, as a matter of faith, believe that she continues to exist in a way that goes beyond the mere butterfly effect of her existence, and that her existence has about it an awareness of the continuation of our love that I continue to honor. I can't explain that by definition, and it is very much a matter of faith, but my modest claim is that I can live the life of science and the mind simultaneously with living the spiritual life that experiences her the way I do.
That is beautiful, and I think it's a wonderful teaching to those of us who love and are loved, whether they're alive or not. It's an important teaching to honor the fact that we are loved and live accordingly.
And I think it is the life lesson that comes out of the course. It's a life lesson of which I was unaware, frankly, until two friends, Doris Kern Goodwin and Tom Oliphant, who come to the class and come as Dodger fans, right? Because Doris has written a wonderful book called Wait Till Next Year, which the students read, and Tom has written an equally wonderful book called Praying for Gil Hodges. And in the last two classes of the course and throughout the book, we use baseball and the Dodgers in particular historically for two classes, and we bring in these three exhibits, and Pete Hamill, my colleague at NYU, who's written a wonderful novel about that, triangulates a rabbi and Jackie Robinson again for this day, called Snow in August, and triangulates Jackie, this rabbi, and a young Italian Catholic teenager. So we're there as kind of incarnations of people for whom the Dodgers took us beyond, you know, through the game to something bigger. And they began to say to me, something's happening here. And what was happening was they and the students and I were beginning to focus on this dimension that the sport was able to reveal in its ineffable moments, the moments where, you know, a son and a father, or in Doris's case, a young girl and her father, are so united in love, and the experience of that love goes so beyond this dimension in which we live day in and day out, that it was put aside as, in Eliot's terms, sacred as opposed to profane.
We've got to take another short break, John, and We're going to come back and continue the discussion. Let me ask you a quick question. What team do you love now?
The Yankees.
Jennifer, my producer, I just want to talk to you for a minute. Why did you get a Yankees person on? I mean, why? We could have done better. Oh, John was listening to that. Sorry.
Yeah, Dan, there are anomalies. We actually, I have found, admit to NYU Red Sox fans.
Thank God. Okay. All right. We're going to take that break, and we'll be back in 60 seconds. John Sexton, he's president of NYU, author of Baseball as a Road to God, Seeing Beyond the Game. I promise I'll do my very best to get a caller in or two in this last segment. Our number is 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb, and you're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
Supporting WHYY, Camp Hill Special School, with day and residential options, is a community committed to the care and education of children ages 4 through 21 with mild to severe intellectual disabilities. Dr. Dan Gottlieb makes a presentation at their Phoenixville campus on April 22nd, and the school hosts an open house at their Glenmore campus on April 27th. To register for the presentation on April 22nd and the open house on April 27th, and for more details, camphillspecialschool.org. 1 in 3 families is affected by problems caused by drugs or alcohol. The Family Training Program is a service for those concerned about their child, age 12 to 25, that may be using drugs or drinking. If eligible, you will be invited to sessions with a family specialist to help make positive changes in your life and in the relationship with your child. Held in Philadelphia by the Treatment Research Institute, a supporter of WHYY. More at 877-I-WORRY-2, 877-I-WORRY-2, or online at iamconcerned.org.
Once there was a silly old ant, thought he'd move a rubber tree plant. Anyone knows an ant can't move a rubber tree plant by
And that was our beloved Harry Callis, Harry the K, singing Rubber Tree Plant. Did you know Harry Callis, John?
No, I never met him, unfortunately. I know of him, of course.
He was wonderful. So we talked about you and the Yankees. So when your Dodgers abandoned you in 1957, you converted to the Yankees over time. Well, now I want to talk about what happened with the birth of your son, Jed. That was a full decade after the Dodgers left. So what happened?
Well, when he was born, I was still at that point a Dodger fan. I wasn't able to use the prefix Los Angeles. They were still the Dodgers to me, and I was helped by the fact that Koufax had grown up in Brooklyn and remained their mainstay, and then Drysdale and Sutton and Osteen. I, in fact, went down to Baltimore in 64 for the World Series. I may have gotten that year wrong, but I'm not an expert on dates. But in any case, Jed, I know, was born in 69, as you say, and I knew that more than giving him his religion, although he was baptized, I would give him the teams for which he rooted. And it seemed I couldn't give him my Dodgers because there'd only be six possible games a year when they were in town. And there was no direct TV, and the box scores weren't in the morning paper. So it was a choice between the Mets, who were the natural descendants, and the Yankees, who of course, were the enemy back in my formative years. And the Mets were having a great year that year, and the Yankees were horrible. And I think it probably was the 50s Catholic in me. I thought about this a lot, you know. But the 50s Catholic with the tradition and saints and so on that caused me to give him the Yankees. And I actually remained a Dodger fan for a while. But then when the Yankees played the Dodgers in the 70s in the World Series, I had to make a decision. Was I going to root against my son's team, or was I going to convert? And it was then when my own conversion occurred because of the predicate decision I'd made in 1969 for him. So I justify this by saying that I did it out of fatherly love, and then, of course, made the transformation. Now, thankfully, we then went into the bad years of the 80s so that it could purify the joint choice.
Wait a minute. You said we went into the bad years of the 80s. Which we are you talking about?
Well, Jed and I and the Yankees, only bad, I should say, in the sense that the Yankees weren't doing well.
Oh, okay.
These were the Yankees of Winfield and Mattingly. So we were able to live together after being, you know, formed as true fans the great years of 95, 96, and thereafter. Now, incidentally, by the way, when I married Lisa, who was Jewish, she asked if we could raise Jed Jewish, and I agreed to that. So he was later bar mitzvahed. And indeed, when he married an Italian Catholic, she converted to Judaism. Converted, in fact, on September the 11th, 2001, she and Lisa and Jed were on the way to the mikveh when the first plane flew over them.
And where was the mikveh, John?
The mikveh was up in the Upper West Side.
Okay.
And they were on their way to the subway on LaGuardia Street in the village, and the plane flew over them. And they thought it was an accident, and then they continued up. But so Danielle is Jewish, as is Jed, and we raised our daughter Jewish, and our three granddaughters are Jewish since Danielle is Jewish. So my Irish Catholic brother-in-law, my sister's husband, says, not since Abraham has a Gentile begat as many Jews as John. But Jed is still a Yankee fan.
Wonderful. I wonder, though, you know, we're talking about conversion and roots. I wonder if religious roots ever really go away. One of my dearest friends and I went to Cooperstown, and one of them had been a Dodgers fan, but now he's a passionate Phillies fan. We go to games all the time. But, you know, when we got to Cooperstown, you'll guess what the first thing he wanted to get. He wanted to get Duke Snider paraphernalia.
Right. Well, happily about the Dodgers, I have found, one can still do that purely. The 1955 World Series will be the only World Series the Brooklyn Dodgers ever win. So it's interesting because Doris Kern Goodwin and Tom and I, all rabid Dodger fans, processed their movement in different ways. I've described what happened to me. Doris became a Red Sox fan through her sons when she was in Boston, and much later. Tom could never root for another team again, and just a generic baseball fan. But one of the students once asked Doris, if you could, would you go back in history and have the Dodgers stay? And one of the interesting things is she said no. And she said no because of the kind of specialness of that team. So it's possible to be a Phillies fan, a rabid Phillies fan, and still root for the Dodgers in illo tempore, in that mythological time.
It's interesting to listen to three of your reactions to the Dodgers. And I was thinking, as a clinician, you know, everybody reacts to loss or betrayal or abandonment in very different ways, and these are three very different reactions. I want to talk again about 9/11, which is how you conclude your book. You conclude with community. And after 9/11, most of the nation felt in community with New York, especially the firefighters. But the issue of baseball came up, and it was really an interesting one. Should we suspend it? Would it be sacrilegious to play? And if we did suspend it, would we be giving in to the enemy? So when we did return to baseball, we were all Yankees fans that first night, and I was moved to tears as I could almost feel myself sitting with those 40,000 people at Yankee Stadium. I think that's where they were playing, as we all prayed in silence.
Yes, and I am now a season ticket holder for the Yankees, and I was at the Yankee Stadium games, and my sister's husband, my friend Mike Murray, the person that said not since Abraham, was with me, and he had conceptualized what would have been a terrific pageant. I mean, I think baseball, in the wake of 9/11. Reacted with kind of pitch-perfect judgment by suspending for a while, but then using the game to bind the nation together again. And you're right to say the world was Yankee fans in the same way that European leaders would say we are all New Yorkers now. And Mike's idea was that if we hoped when, but it turned out not to be, but if the Yankees won the World Series and they came so close, and the way they lost was almost emblematic of the way baseball captures the human imperfection. But his idea was to reverse the normal parade of champions, which goes through the canyons of downtown New York, start it uptown and have it end at Ground Zero. And boy, that just would have been phenomenal.
Oh, my gosh.
Think of it in terms of the ritual, which is, and then the liturgy, which is the theme of this book.
John, unfortunately, we're just out of time. We just hit the deadline. I want to invite you to come down to Philly. You'll see a team that's going to remind you of the old Brooklyn Dodgers. Thanks so much.
Well, they are a wonderful team, and this has been wonderful with you, Dan.
Yeah, I have too, John. Thanks so much. We've been talking about connections between the experience of baseball and religion with John Sexton, author of Baseball as a Road to God. I want to end the show on a light note. Let's listen to a piece of George Carlin's comedy routine I spoke of earlier in the show.
Baseball is different from any other sport in a lot of different little ways. For instance, in most sports, you score points or you score goals. In baseball, you score runs. In most sports, the ball or the object is put in play by the offensive team. In baseball, the defense puts the ball in play, and only the defensive team is allowed to touch the ball. In fact, in baseball, if an offensive player touches the ball intentionally, he's out. Also, most sports, the team is run by a coach. In baseball, the team is run by a manager. And only in baseball does the manager or the coach have to wear the same uniform the players do. Can you picture Bill Parcells in his New York Giants uniform? Now, baseball and football are different from one another in other kind of interesting ways, I think. First of all, baseball is a 19th century pastoral game. Football is a 20th century technological struggle. Baseball is played on a diamond in a park, the baseball park. Football is played on a gridiron in a stadium, sometimes called Soldier Field or War Memorial Stadium.
And that was the late, great George Carlin. That's all for today. Next week on Voices in the Family, we're going to look at family life when a parent has a mental illness. Hey, visit us on whyy.org/voices, where you can comment on the show or download this show or any others there or on iTunes. And follow us on Twitter. We're at Voices in the Fam. I'm at drdangottlieb.com. Hey, by the way, I'm going to be giving a couple of talks soon. One is at Newman University on Saturday, April 20th, entitled The Autism Puzzle, Fitting the Pieces Together. The other is at the Camp Hill Special School on April 22nd, entitled Our Children, Our Teachers. You can get more information about that on our webpage. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez Luna is the executive producer of audio content. Emily Haas is our production assistant. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn is our producer. I'm Dan Gottlieb, a huge Phillies fan. Hey, have a great week, my friends.
Just ahead.